Well, ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the 12th and penultimate lecture in a series of lectures in Law and Society, organised by my colleagues in the Law Department to celebrate the centenary of the London School of Economics and Political Science. We have ranged widely in our lectures, from contract law through legal anthropology, back to tax and public law, on to legal theory, and then in the last fortnight to labour and international law. This week we turn to commercial law, which has a long distinguished tradition in the Law Department. We're very fortunate in our lecturer this evening. Mrs. Justice Arden began her brilliant career in the law at Girton College, Cambridge, before attending the Harvard Law School. On her return from the United States, she did pupillage with that doyen of the company law bar, Richard Sykes. She was in silk before the age of 40, and as well as her busy practice at the Chancery Bar, wrote extensively, in particular in the area of company law. She's one of the editors of Buckley, amongst other things. In 1993, she became the first woman member of the Chancery Division of the High Court, thus trumping her husband, whose own appointment to the High Court bench followed a little later. Dame Mary has a long record in public service, some 20 years membership of the Law Society Committee on Company Law, and now also membership of the Financial Law Panel. As I know from the inside, she set a cracking pace as the chairman of the Chancery Group examining the implementation of the All Proposals on Access to Justice. I'm also very pleased to say that she's an honorary member of the Society for Public Teachers of Law and has already been conscripted into service in that regard. Her lecture this evening is entitled Codifying Directors' Duties. This is Justice Arden.
Ladies and gentlemen, good evening, and welcome to this topic of codifying directors' duties. Thank you, Professor Cranston, for your kind words of welcome. Tomorrow, ladies and gentlemen, is Budget Day, and this time last year, the Chancellor of the Exchequer, in his budget speech, took the opportunity to support a law reform measure designed to assist small companies and which originated in an idea of Professor Moore of this university. Suppose that the Chancellor is still looking for ideas as to what to say tomorrow in his budget speech. Would we urge him to include in his speech a proposal to codify the duties of a director of a company? Would his budget speech then be acclaimed by the directors of UK PLC for its far-sighted and wise approach? To answer this question, I have a few slides to show you, which I will endeavour to put on the machine here, I hope that you will find that this topic is one of some interest. Before I start, let me say just a very little about the fiduciary duties of directors as they stand at the moment. Obviously, any discussion of the precise content of those duties could fill the whole of this lecture on its own. I propose simply to work on the basis that the main features of the director's fiduciary duty are as described in Gower's Principles of Modern Company Law. There, the editors say that there are effectively four branches to the duty. First, directors must act bona fide in what they consider is in the best interests of the company. And those are the words used by Lord Green, Master of the Rolls, in Smith and Fawcett in 1942. Directors, therefore, cannot use their powers to benefit third parties, more especially not themselves. Secondly, says Gower, directors must exercise their powers for the purpose for which those powers are conferred. This is a different and additional requirement from the first. It has been applied, for example, in relation to the power to allot shares. It is not enough that the directors consider that the allotment of shares will be in the company's interests. The allotment must be for one of the purposes for which the power is permitted to be exercised under the company's constitution. Thirdly, says Gower, directors must not in general fetter their discretion, and this means that they cannot agree with a third party as to how they will exercise their discretion. To do so would prevent them from exercising an independent judgment when the time comes, and then they must ask themselves what is in the company's best interests. Fourthly, says Gower, directors must not place themselves in a position where their duties to the company will or may conflict with their personal interests or with their duties to third parties, for example, if they have duties to other companies of which they are also directors. This rule means that directors cannot enter into contracts with their company unless they make full disclosure of their interests and the company duly approves the contract. If the necessary disclosure is not made, the contract is voidable at the instance of the company unless the right to avoid has been lost under the general law. Now, there's a second and separate aspect of this rule, and that is that directors cannot keep secret profits which they make by using information or property or opportunities which belong to their company. A classic example of this is the case of Independent Consultants and Cooley in 1972. In that case, the defendant was the former managing director of the plaintiffs. He resigned his office in order to enable him to take up in his own name a valuable contract which had previously been sought by his own company. But the company's approach had been rejected. The defendant was then approached in his private capacity. He saw the possibility of getting the contract himself, and so he resigned as managing director. Subsequently, he indeed got the contract, but he did this by reason of work he had previously done for the plaintiff while he was still managing director. It was held that he was accountable to the plaintiff company for all the profit that he made on the contract because he had allowed his interest and duty to conflict and had failed to disclose the private approach which was made to him to his own company before he resigned. He should have passed on the information about that private approach to his company. Mr. Justice Roskell, now Lord Roskell, referred to the well-known authorities such as Keachin Sandford, Regal Hastings and Gulliver, and Phipps and Boardman, and he also cited the following passage from the judgment of Lord Justice James in Parker and McKenna, a case in 1874. Lord Justice James said, "I do not think it is necessary, but it appears to me very important that we should concur in laying down again and again the general principle that in this court no agent in the course of his agency, in the matter of his agency, can be allowed to make any profit without the knowledge and consent of his principal, and that rule is an inflexible rule and must be applied inexorably by this court, which is not entitled, in my judgment, to receive evidence or suggestion or argument as to whether the principal did or did not suffer any injury, in fact, by reason of the dealing of the agent. For the safety of mankind requires that no agent shall be able to put his principal to the danger of such an inquiry as that." Mr. Justice Roskell continued, "In the nuclear age, that last sentence may perhaps seem something of an exaggeration, but nonetheless it is eloquent of the strictness with which throughout the last century, and indeed in the present century, courts of the highest authority have always applied this rule." To Gower's analysis of the fiduciary duty, there is one more aspect of the fiduciary duty which I would add, and it's really self-evident, and it is that directors must act in accordance with the company's constitution. So, for example, if the articles say that dividends must not be paid otherwise than out of revenue profits, it will be a breach of duty for directors to pay dividends out of capital profits. Separate from his fiduciary duty is a further duty, the director's duty of skill and care, and that is a matter with which I would like to return hereafter. For I now return to that question that I put a moment ago, and my question was, should the Chancellor, if he's still chewing the end of his pencil, consider including in his budget speech tomorrow some proposal to codify directors' duties. If we look again at Gower, we find a footnote to say this, that an attempt was earlier made to codify directors' duties, but it proved abortive to the regret of those of us who believe that a comprehensive statutory restatement of those duties would make it more likely that they are observed, a belief strengthened by the fact that the main reason for giving up the attempt was the impossibility of obtaining agreement of the legal profession on precisely what the duties are. So that suggests that the learned editors of Gower took the view, or some of them did, that consolidation was a good idea. Now, the question of codifying directors' duties was considered by the Company Law Committee in 1962. That is the committee that we call the Jenkins Committee, because it was chaired by Lord Justice Jenkins. The report of the Jenkins Committee deals with the point very briefly. It records that it had received arguments for and against codification. It stated that the arguments in favour of codification were really twofold. First, the duties of directors are currently to be found in complex case law. Chapter and verse was not given of this, but if you again take Gower, it deals with fiduciary duties in some 21 pages, in the course of which it cites over 60 cases. And this work is sparing and judicious in its citation of authority. The second reason given by the Jenkins Committee was this, that evidence had been given to that committee that the law on directors' duties was inaccessible to company directors. It then cited some arguments that it had received against codification. First, it was impossible to define directors' duties exhaustively. And secondly, it was said in evidence to the committee that there was a danger that there would be lacunae or gaps in which it would be more difficult to say what the law was if there was a statutory statement of directors' duties. As to that, I would like to add in parenthesis that looking at the size and density of modern company legislation, the idea that case law is inaccessible but statute law is not, it seems to me pie in the sky. Anyway, be that as it may, the Jenkins Committee came down, as one might expect, neatly between the two views. What it recommended was an explicit statement of the basic principles underlying the relationship which a director had with his company. The Jenkins Committee set out in their report exactly what they thought that statement should say. Now, the government of the day did not implement that recommendation immediately, and it was not until 1973 that the Jenkins Committee recommendations found themselves into a bill, and the bill in question was the Companies Bill 1973. Clause 52, which sets out what the Jenkins Committee had recommended, is a model of brevity. I hope that you can see that. That sets out the first clause which the Jenkins Committee wanted to see in an Act of Parliament as setting out directors' duties, and it says that a director of a company shall observe the utmost good faith towards the company in any transaction with it or on its behalf, and shall act honestly in the exercise of the powers and the discharge of the duties of his office. I'll come back to talk about that in a moment. There was a second sub-clause, which I will now show you. This states that a director of a company shall not make use of any money or other property of the company, or of any information acquired by him by virtue of his position as a director or other officer of the company, to gain directly or indirectly an improper advantage for himself at the expense of the company. Just ask you to note those final words. There were then just two more clauses, sub-clauses within the clause in the Companies Bill 1973, which dealt with remedies in the first case. And lastly, subsection 4 provided, this section is without prejudice to any other provision of the Companies Act and to any rule of law with respect to the duties and liabilities of directors. So the proposal in 1973 was to have simply that very simple statement of directors' duties, which would not be a comprehensive statement, but merely, as the Jenkins Committee put it, set out the basic principle. The Companies Bill 1973 was in fact lost because of a general election, and it was not until 1978 that another bill was put forward with a clause designed to deal with directors' duties. By this time, the simple clause which had been recommended by the Jenkins Committee was changed almost out of all recognition. Sub-clause 1, which stated a duty of utmost good faith, remained the same, but the effect of the clause as a whole was fundamentally different from what the Jenkins Committee had recommended. I'm not going to show you subclause 1 again at this stage, but these were the further provisions of the Companies Bill 1978, clause 44. Subclause 2 provided that a director should not do anything or omit to do anything if the doing of that thing or the omission to do it, as the case may be, gives rise to a conflict or might reasonably be expected to give rise to a conflict between his private interests and the duties of his office. There was then a very complicated subclause 3, this is almost tailor-made to deal with the situation that arose in industrial developments and Cooley. It provides that a director of a company, or a person who has been a director of a company, like Mr. Cooley himself, should not, for the purpose of gaining, whether directly or indirectly, an advantage for himself, make use of any money or other property of the company, or make use of any relevant information or relevant opportunity. And then there were two possibilities. If he did so while a director of the company, in circumstances which give rise or which might reasonably be expected to give rise to a conflict, or if while a director he had that use in contemplation, in circumstances which gave rise or might reasonably have been expected to give rise to such a conflict, which, of course, had been the situation in the Cooley case. There were then, in subclause 4, some complicated definitions of relevant information and relevant opportunity. Relevant information meant, effectively, information which a director got while he was a director and which he was under a duty to disclose to the company, or which it was reasonable to expect him to disclose to the company. Subclause 5 then dealt with the liability to account. Then there was a subclause 6 in these terms. Person shall not be liable under the foregoing provisions of this section for any act or omission which is duly authorised or ratified. And I'll come back to say a little about that in a moment. And then, and this is an extremely important provision, there appeared the last subclause, subclause 7. Section has effect instead of any rule of law stating the fiduciary duties of directors of companies, but without prejudice to any remedies that may be available apart from this section for breach of any duty or to any other provision of the Companies Acts imposing duties or liabilities on such directors or defining their duties or liabilities. is a fundamental difference from what the Jenkins Committee had recommended. Now, that clause in the Companies Bill 1978 simply bristles with unanswered questions. Let us go back to subclause one. I'm going to go back to it on the slide for the Companies Bill 1973, but it is in fact the same subclause in the Companies Bill 1978. This subclause uses a phrase which is simply not familiar to company lawyers at all. It speaks of utmost good faith. That is a phrase with which anyone who is familiar with insurance law will recognise. It's also sometimes used in agency. But as I mentioned a moment ago, company lawyers are more used to the duty being expressed as a duty to act in the best interests of the company. However, you can say this about the phrase. It has the phrase utmost good faith has the right ring about it. It is suitably weighty. It reaches out to the highest standards of behaviour, and that, I suggest, is an appropriate aspiration in the context of directors who are stewards of the funds of other people. It also connotes, if one thinks of it in the insurance context, full disclosure, which is also an integral part of a director's duties. But that said, the phrase is one which is very general in its meaning and very open textured. The courts would, if this clause had become law, have had to expound its meaning as new cases came along. That means, as I see it, that there would have been no added certainty to what the law on directors' duties was. Indeed, quite the contrary, I suggest there would be more litigation after the bill became law than before. If there was a case which, before the new provision became law, would have involved a breach of duty, no doubt it would have been argued that it was no longer caught because the duty had been restated. If it was a case which did not involve a breach of fiduciary duty under the old law, it would be argued that it was now caught by the statutory duty. So far from reducing litigation, it seems to me that to codify directors' duties in this way would have in fact led to more litigation and dispute as to what the law actually was. On the other hand, that said, the phrase comes from the Jenkins Committee and is one which I believe would have been most carefully chosen by it, and is one which, as I see it, also has some clear advantages. It is, I think, a phrase which has a dynamic of its own, and it would be difficult for the courts to say at any point in time that it could be definitively defined in any case so as to prevent the further development of the law. So, if Parliament were to enact something like this, with the concept of utmost good faith, the law would not, as I see it, become inflexible. All that would happen is that the basic principle would be found in the statute, and it would be for the court to say, in any individual context, whether the duty of utmost good faith was indeed fulfilled. In that way, the law would retain its inbuilt flexibility, which it has at the moment, and which is so important in the field of fiduciary duties. The phrase of utmost good faith would be comparable to other open-textured phrases that we find in the Companies Act. For instance, in sections 226 and 227, there is a requirement that accounts give a true and fair view. Another similar type of requirement, another similar type of provision, can be found in section 459, which gives the court jurisdiction to grant relief on the application of a minority shareholder where, quote, unfairly prejudicial, end quote, conduct occurs. The courts have not been able to define those phrases exhaustively, but have only been able to give guidelines as to what those phrases mean. Now, if we look back at subclause one, as the Jenkins Committee designed it, there is no reference to a duty to use powers for a proper purpose. That particular duty, and you will recall it's one of those identified by Gower, has long been part of our law and it has received the approval of the Privy Council in Howard Smith and Ampol in 1974. In that case, there were two shareholders, Ampol and Bulkships, who held 55% of the shares of Miller's Limited. Ampol made an offer for the issued shares of Miller's. Howard Smith announced its intention to make a higher offer. The board of Miller's quickly allotted shares to Howard Smith, with the result that the 55% majority shareholding of Ampol and Miller's was reduced to 35%. Ampol Limited sought a declaration that this allotment was invalid. Howard Smith and Miller's argued that the allotment was for a proper purpose, since Miller's required substantial further capital for its own business. The trial judge found that its need for capital was not immediate, and in addition that the primary purpose of the allotment was to reduce the holdings of Ampol Limited and Bulkships, and thereby facilitate Howard Smith's offer. The Privy Council upheld the finding of the trial judge that the directors had improperly exercised their powers. And it's important to understand exactly what was being argued in that case. On one side, it was argued that once it was shown that the directors had acted in what they considered to be bona fide acted in what they considered to be the company's interests, that was the end of the matter, provided it was could not be shown that they were motivated by self-interest and that what they really had in mind was the interest of the directors, then the court should not inquire any further. The argument on the opposite side is that the only way, a reason for which directors could properly issue shares was to enable capital to be raised, and once the judge had found that the issue was not made to raise capital, the allotment must be invalid. The Privy Council rejected both those arguments. Self-interest, said the Privy Council, was one, but no doubt the commonest instance of improper motive, but before one can say that a fiduciary power has been exercised for the purpose for which it was conferred, a wider investigation may have to be made. On the other hand, said the Privy Council, it is too narrow to say that the only valid purpose for which shares can be allotted is to raise capital. The discretion is not limited that way in the articles, and the law should therefore not impose that limitation upon directors. And the Privy Council continued, to define in advance the exact limits beyond which directors must not pass is, in their lordship's view, impossible. It cannot be done by use of a phrase such as bona fide in the interests of the company as a whole. That phrase, if it does anything more than restate the general principle applicable to fiduciary powers, at best serves negatively to exclude from the area of validity cases where directors are acting sectionally or partially, for instance, where they're improperly favouring one section of shareholders against another. So, in the Privy Council's view, what had to be done was to consider the power in question, the power to allot shares, and to continue in this way. Privy Council said, having ascertained on a fair view the nature of the power to allot shares, and having defined as best as can be done in the light of modern conditions the or some limits within which it may be exercised, it is then necessary for the court, if a particular exercise of it is challenged, to examine the substantial purpose for which it was exercised and to reach a conclusion as to whether that purpose was proper or not. And in doing so, it will necessarily give credit, and this is a separate point, to the bona fide opinion of the directors, if such is found to exist, and will respect their judgment as to matters of management. Having done this, the ultimate conclusion has to be as to the side of a fairly broad line on which the case falls. Now, it has been argued that the proper purpose doctrine, as elucidated in cases like Howard Smith, is in some way superfluous. In the Howard Smith case itself, the allotment was in fact held to be invalid because the reason why the directors had exercised the power was to alter the majority shareholding of Ampol and Bulk ships, and that was not a proper purpose for exercising the power to allot. But recently it has been argued that we can simply jettison the proper purpose doctrine. The argument runs something like this, that provided that the courts apply an objective standard to determining what the interests of the company are, so that directors must act not only in what they consider to be in the interests of the company, but also in what, objectively speaking, constitutes the company's interests. That is enough. And there is no need to apply any proper purpose test. But I suggest that the facts of Howard Smith and Ampol show that it is not easy for the court to resolve what, objectively speaking, constitutes the best interests of the company. There was dispute there as to whether it was in the best interest of the company that it should be taken over by Howard Smith or not. One does not have to ascertain what constitutes the proper purpose or apply that test is, as I see it, to misunderstand the function of the proper purpose test as a means of judicial scrutiny of the exercise by directors of their powers. As the Privy Council said in that passage which was on the screen, the court cannot decide commercial issues. On that sort of issue, they defer to the judgment of directors. As Howard Smith shows. If the proper purpose doctrine were removed, courts, in my view, could not be expected effectively to test what directors do by reference to what, objectively speaking, is in the interest of the company, because the courts are simply not in a position to reach views on those sorts of issues. And it is no doubt for that sort of reason that the courts do not, in general, regard mismanagement of a company's affairs as capable of being unfairly prejudicial conduct. It has to be serious mismanagement for the courts to regard it as unfairly prejudicial. Courts cannot effectively test what is or is not, objectively speaking, in the interests of the company, but they can scrutinise what directors do by the criterion of proper purpose. If the proper purpose doctrine were lost, then one of the most important weapons in the judicial armoury for making directors accountable to their shareholders would be lost too. Some of you may have heard Lord Irvine of Legge's recent address to the Administrative Law Bar Association. And in the course of that address, Lord Irvine referred to the importance of the proper purpose doctrine in the context of judicial review of administrative action. What he said was this: just as the courts may construe a statute as requiring the inclusion or exclusion of a particular consideration, so also it is for the court to determine the policy and objects or purposes of the act by construing it as a whole. The consequence is that the activities of public bodies are constrained not only by the express words of the statute, but also by such purposes as the court may think fit to imply from the statute as a whole when the decision is challenged. The determination of a statutory purpose is a hard-edged decision, a matter of law for the court. It arises prior to the assessment of the relevance of the factors which may have been taken into account by the authority, and to a large extent will condition the outcome of that assessment. The characterization by a court of what would undoubtedly qualify as a relevant consideration as the purpose of the statute plainly restricts the decision maker's discretion to adopt other considerations as relevant. That was said in the context of judicial review of administrative action. But the proper purpose doctrine is a recurrent technique in our jurisdiction, and it forms an essential part also of the judicial review of directors' actions. Of course, nothing was said by the Jenkins Committee in their subclause 1 about proper purpose, or indeed about the courts respecting the commercial judgment of directors. But as I see it, neither of those concepts is inconsistent with the concept of good faith, utmost good faith. Had subclause 1 become law, I would have expected the courts to have come to the conclusion that the concept of proper purpose and the respect for commercial judgment of directors still applied under the new law. In the same way, maybe it's helpful for you to have subclause 1 back again. In the same way, nothing is said about the duty to observe the terms of the company's constitution. But as I see it, this would also be caught by a concept of utmost good faith. How does a director exhibit utmost good faith if he simply rides roughshod over the articles or memorandum? In addition, the advantage of this particular formulation was that it didn't have to go into the niceties of who was the company, or what interests represented the company for the purpose of the duty as formulated by Gower, namely a duty to act in the best interests of the company. Sometimes the interests of the company will mean the company as a separate legal entity, and that is its usual meaning. In deciding what their duty is to the company in this sense requires the directors to take into account others whose well-being furthers the interests of the company, and therefore in some cases the interests of employees can be taken into account for this purpose. And this is now expressly recognised in the Companies Act, and section 309 of the Companies Act 1985 provides that the matters to which the directors of a company are to have regard in the performance of their functions include the interests of the company's employees in general, as well as the interests of its members. And subsection 2 provides the duty imposed by this section on directors is owed by them to the company and to the company alone. The question of who the company is a vexed question. Section 309, which I just read, refers to the interests of the members. And there are occasions when the exercise of powers may affect members as well as, or even to the exclusion of the company as a separate legal entity. Take the case of dividends. The exercise by directors of their power to recommend dividends may be in the interests of current members, but may be contrary to the interests of the company as a separate legal entity, since it is often in the interests of the company, as a separate legal entity, to retain profits. Another example can be given from the Australian case of Mills and Mills. In that case, the director's action affected members only, but not the company as a separate legal entity. What happened was this. The company's capital comprised two classes of shares, ordinary shares and preference shares. The latter ranked pari passu with the ordinary shares and carried the right to vote. The directors proposed to make a bonus issue of voting shares to the ordinary shareholders alone, and the issue would have the effect of altering the voting power between the two classes. The question whether such shares could be issued or not would have no effect on the company as a separate legal entity, but mattered greatly to its shareholders. The same issue arose in the English context in the case of Mutual Life Insurance and the Rank organisation in 1985. In that case, the directors of Rank had given shareholders, other than North American shareholders, the right to subscribe for new shares of the same class. There was evidence that the North Americans had been excluded because the company did not wish to comply with the requirements for registration of the Securities and Exchange Commission in the United States and with comparable commissions in Canada. The directors had had advice, which they had accepted, from merchant bankers, in turn based on an investigation by accountants, that to register with the SEC would not be in the interests of their company. The plaintiffs were North Americans. They owned shares in Rank, and they claimed that Rank had acted in breach of the membership contract contained in the articles. They claimed that their shares entitled them to equal treatment without discrimination, one from another. Mr. Justice Goulding rejected the argument in light of the wide powers which the directors had under the articles. He held that the directors' power of allotment was only to be cut down by two implied terms. Only two implied terms. First, the time-honoured rule that directors' powers are to be exercised in good faith in the interests of the company. Second, they must be exercised fairly as between different shareholders. I doubt whether it is possible to formulate either of these stipulations more precisely because of the infinity of circumstances in which they may fall to be applied. And on the facts of the case, Mr. Justice Goulding held that it was abundantly clear that the directors had indeed acted in the best interests of Rank and that there had been no unfairness between the two groups of shareholders. The case shows how the interests of the company are not simply limited to the interests of the company as a separate legal entity. And there is one last case which I would like to show you, which has the same effect, but a different duty this time. In the case of Winkworth and Barron in the House of Lords in 1986, the facts were roughly as follows. A husband and wife occupied a property which their company owned. The company then became heavily insolvent, and the wife sought to argue that the company had agreed to sell her an interest in the property, and that arose when she paid some money to the company, which coincidentally was used to pay off the overdraft, which had been incurred to buy the property in the first place. So, she said, there was a resulting trust. The House of Lords refused to hold that there was a resulting trust in her favour. Lord Templeman used the words, "Equity is not a computer." He was particularly influenced by the fact that the company was insolvent, and he said that a duty was owed by the directors of the company to the company and the creditors of the company to ensure that the affairs of the company are properly administered and that its property is not dissipated or exploited for the benefit of the directors themselves to the prejudice of the creditors. Far from holding, therefore, that the wife had a share in the property which she and her husband occupied, their lordships held that since she'd committed misfeasance, the money which she paid in simply went to pay off some of the amount that she owed the company as a result of her misfeasance. So there is the court recognising that in some circumstances the duty to the company is in reality a duty to the creditors. So much then for subclause 1 of the 1978 bill, which, as I mentioned, was the clause which the Jenkins Committee had formulated as their subclause 1-2. If I may run quickly through the other provisions and comment on them. Subclause 2 contained a blanket prohibition on the doing of anything which might give rise to a conflict between the director's private interests and the duties of his office. This is all right as far as it goes, but it omits a great deal. In the case of almost all companies, there are articles of association which allow a director to have conflicts under certain strict conditions. See, for example, Table A, Article 85. A second point which I would like to make by way of comment is that the clause makes no reference to the conflicting interests which a director may have not because they're private interests, but they're because they're interests which he has by virtue of some other duty to some other company or any other sort of interest. I've commented on subclause 3, which was the long clause dealing with relevant opportunity and relevant information. It omitted the words which the Jenkins Committee had mentioned, which you may recall, at the expense of the company. But it was a convoluted clause. Subclause 6 was the clause which purported to deal with authority and ratification. It says, with seeming simplicity and neatness, a person is not liable for any act or omission which is duly authorised or ratified. But that takes the reader and the user very little way. It doesn't tell him who can authorise or ratify. If it's only going to be the company in general meeting who can ratify, are there to be any limits on its ability to do so? Presumably the act would have to be intra vires at the very least. Could you ratify something that was done in bad faith? Did the company have to be fully solvent after it had ratified the act? And did the company have to have an ability to meet its obligations in the foreseeable future, even after the ratification? Did the ratification have to be unanimous? None of these questions are answered by subclause 6, and therefore it's difficult to see what purpose there might be in putting such a provision into the Companies Act. I'd like to remind you of this clause. This is the one which I said was very important. It means that the basic statement of duties, the principles affecting the duties of directors, which the Jenkins Committee had recommended, was metamorphosed into a comprehensive statutory code. This was done, notwithstanding that in 1925 there had been another committee which had considered the codification of directors' duties, the Green Committee on Company Law Amendment, and they had said succinctly, to attempt by statute to define the duties of directors would be a hopeless task. Moreover, by putting all the duties into a comprehensive code and substituting a statutory duty for the fiduciary duty at common law, the clause, if it had become law, would have radically altered limitation periods. At common law, there was no set period if the director received company property or if the breach of duty was fraudulent, though laches and acquiescence would apply. Under the proposed statutory code, the limitation period would have been only 6 years. Before I leave the Companies Bill 1978, I would point out briefly that it also dealt with duties of skill and care. There are two branches. The first deals with care and diligence, and the second deals with the skill that is to be expected of a director. At common law, at least until recently, a director was not bound to give continuous attention to the affairs of his company, and therefore a director would be unlikely to be held responsible for what happened at a board meeting that he didn't attend. Clause 45, subclause 1 of the Companies Bill 1978 would have altered that, because if that it had been enacted, he would have been expected to be as diligent as a reasonably prudent person. But in fact, the law was changed in a slightly different way by a decision of Mr. Justice Hoffman, as he then was, in Dejan of London Limited in 1994. In that case, Mr. Justice Hoffman held that the duty of common law was the same as that set out in section 214, subsection 4 of the Insolvency Act 1986, that is, a duty to conduct himself as a reasonably diligent person, having both the general knowledge, skill and experience that may reasonably be expected of a person carrying out the same functions as are carried out by that director in relation to the company, and B, the general knowledge, skill and experience that that director has. That case, Dejan of London in 1994, was an interesting example of the common law developing in line with a changing environment. There was no Court of Appeal authority which prevented a court of first instance from restating the law which previously had been thought to have been established by Mr. Justice Romer in 1925. Mr. Justice Romer's standard had been much criticised as being too low. One can only admire the way in which the law was brought into line with modern expectations by Mr. Justice Hoffman. And in my judgment, this would have happened even if Section 214 had not been happened. And what it's more, it would have happened even if Clause 45 had not been enacted. So, looking at the second branch of Section 45, that requires a director to show the skill that a director of his knowledge and experience could reasonably show. So if he was a qualified professional person, he must show the knowledge and experience of such a person, and this marked no change in the law. Perhaps the standard is still too favourable to the director. One thing you will have observed as we looked at the company's bills is that our first instinct when faced with a statutory provision is to look at its precise wording and to analyse it in those terms. So, the nature of the argument will change if there's a codification of directors' duties. Time will have to be spent, which is not currently spent, and that time would be spent on a textual analysis of words. Now, of course, the process of statutory interpretation is not simply a question of finding the dictionary meaning of words. The court has to find the meaning which Parliament intended for those words. There may be many factors which go into that process, including an assessment of what Parliament intended to achieve. But the courts cannot rewrite what is there. They cannot substitute a provision which they think Parliament should have enacted. They cannot write in a new rule for a situation which Parliament did not foresee. They are stuck with what is there. So it's important to point out one further point before we leave the company's bill, that it has not been suggested that there is something in Clause 44 which was not there at common law. This is not a case where the statutory intervention was necessary so as to rectify some wrong turn which the courts had taken in the law of fiduciary duties. So on that, my conclusion, which I would like to leave with you, is that the 1978 Companies Bill may have had some merits, but it certainly would not have produced certainty. It would not have been an answer to any problem. It would not have predicted the outcome of any particular case more accurately. It would simply, as I see it, have increased, not reduced, the scope for argument and litigation. The real argument which we have to consider when we talk about directors' duties and codifying them is one of transparency. The law should be such that anyone who looks for it will find it, and that it can be explained to him in reasonably comprehensible terms. He should not have to look to his lawyer whenever he needs to know the basic principles. In this country, we expect high standards of our directors. Directors of larger concerns will find themselves pilloried in the press if they get it seriously wrong. They may find themselves criticised in an inspector's report. They may even find themselves defendants in disqualification proceedings. Disqualifying a director, however, is like shutting the stable door after the horse has bolted. What a director needs is help before he does the wrong thing, not afterwards. But in this field of directors' duties, it is not only in the Companies Act that the relevant duties are to be found. The Companies Acts do tell a director that annual financial statements for which they are responsible must contain a large number of specific items, and they also tell him that they must give a true and fair view. But what that phrase means is not elucidated in the Companies Act. To find out what it means, the director has to look at accounting standards set by the accounting standards boards. Likewise, the case law tells the director what he must do to fulfil his duties of skill and care. It simply tells him, however, what the duty is. If he is a director of a company which trades in derivatives, how does he know in advance what to do? He has to look outside the law and look at the practice in the industry. So, at all events, even if we were to have a statutory code or a statutory statement of directors' duties, it could not possibly tell a director what he should do in a comprehensive way. I suggest that for directors, a much more broadly based solution than a statutory statement is needed. I suggest also that what is needed is something which is user-driven rather than lawyer-driven. Let us start by abandoning the idea of a statutory code or a statutory statement of directors' duties. And let us look for other ways in which we can make sure that directors can understand their responsibilities. Let us consider the possibility and the desirability of directors having some training, if they're not already accountants or lawyers, or people who have some other qualification which gives them adequate knowledge of their duties. The law could provide, for instance, that every director who is disqualified by the court should undergo some training before he acts as a director again. The law could also provide that a standard setting body should be set up to give guidance to directors and to develop a code for the conduct of directors. But this would be difficult to cover all subjects comprehensively in this way, and certainly there would need to be resources. It's difficult just at the moment to see where those would come from. The further difficulty would be that such a code would probably not be read by those who most need it. For their purposes, some fairly general brochure is needed, much the same as the court's charter or the guide to bankruptcy which the insolvency service produces. If you go into many firms of solicitors and accountants today, you will find a rack of brochures telling you what you should do in all sorts of situations, including if you are a director in trouble or want to know how to comply with the Data Protection Act or the New Trademarks Act or this Act or the other Act. It surely would not be difficult for a committee of the great and the good, with the representatives from both professions, to produce some type of brochure of this kind for company directors. The Department of Trade and Industry could then get the support of as many institutions as possible as it could to its contents and make it available to directors, just as the Guide to Bankruptcy is made available to people who unfortunately are made bankrupt. There's nothing particularly new in this suggestion. The Cadbury Committee was set up by the Financial Reporting Council to examine the duties of directors in financial matters, and they came up with the Cadbury Code. This is an authority which I hope would be taken into account by the court in deciding whether the conduct of a director was acceptable in respect of any matter covered by the code. Something similar has already been done in Australia. In June of 1994, the Australian Securities Commission and the Australian Society of Certified Practicing Accountants and the Institute of Chartered Accountants in Australia jointly published a booklet designed to assist directors in meeting their duties and legal responsibilities. It had the winning title of The Company Director's Survival Kit, What You Need to Know About the Duties of Company's Directors. And it was aimed at people becoming directors, particularly smaller private companies. It covers the director's duty to act honestly, to exercise care and diligence, not to use inside information, not to make improper use of company property. It also dealt with matters such as insolvent trading and the administration and the financial responsibilities of directors. When it was introduced, the executive director of the Australian Society of Certified Practicing Accountants said that the Australian economy would be the ultimate beneficiary of directors who know their obligations. And the executive director of the Institute of Chartered Accountants of Australia said this: arriving in the aftermath of the corporate collapses and irresponsible business behaviour of the 1980s, the company director's survival kit is a practical guide for a much more pragmatic, responsible decade. For those about to become directors for the first time, I believe it will be indispensable. Such a booklet as I have in mind could be revised as necessary. Further, in the development of directors' duties, I see a role also for the courts. I would hope that as the law on directors' disqualification and unfair prejudice develops, the court will explain and expound the law on directors' duties, and do so by reference to the standards established by authoritative sources, such as the Cadbury Committee. Finally, may I leave with you this thought. As you will know, when directors are appointed or there's a change in directors, there has to be a return made to the company's registry. That return must set out, of course, the director's name, his address and his occupation, his date of birth, and his other directorships. At the bottom of the form, the director has to sign his name. Why not simply add to that form the following? He has at the moment to say, I consent to act as a director of the above-named company, and then he has to sign and date the form. Why not put a warning on the bottom? When you agree to be a director, you agree to accept the responsibilities which the law imposes on directors. These are summarised on the back of this form. By signing this form, you acknowledge that you have read that summary. Now you all want to know what's on the back of the form. What I would put on the back of the form would be something extremely brief. Seek to adopt the Jenkins approach of merely setting out the basic principles. The main duties of a director are to act in good faith in the interests of the company, to use his powers only for proper purposes, to comply with the company's memorandum and articles, and to comply with the duties which the Companies Act and other legislation impose on directors. And then this: if you are not clear as to your duties as a director in any situation, you are advised to consult your solicitor or local law centre or Citizens Advice Bureau. And then, if you do not comply with your duties as a director, you may incur civil or criminal responsibility, or you may be disqualified by the court from acting as a director. Every person, therefore, who became a director would have to look at this form, and as I see it, it would bring to his attention that which it said is currently inaccessible to him, namely a short and summary statement, but I would hope it would be an accurate statement of his duties. And if it were thought to be a helpful idea, he could be reminded of his duties in this way by having to sign a similar form each year when the annual return is prepared and submitted to the company's registry. Can I thank you in the end for coming to listen to this lecture? It's been an enormous honour for me to be asked to give this lecture in the LSE's centenary year. And from my point of view, it's a very welcome opportunity to think about the law in general, rather than in the context of a particular case. But in the time available, I feel it has only been possible to take the to give it a quick stir. I've not been able to do more than to point to some of the aspects of this problem. It deserves much more thought and discussion, as directors' duties are, in truth, one of the most important areas of company law. And one of the ways in which you can test that is by looking at the number of times it arises in the law report. If you look at Butterworth's company law cases for 1995 alone, then you will find that there are no less than 18 cases which refer to directors' duties. I also think it's probably one of the areas of law in which shareholders and directors most commonly seek advice. I only hope that if the question of a statutory statement of directors' duties is pursued, those who make the decisions will have the judgment to decide what it is they can really improve by statutory intervention, and the courage to make those changes, and above all, the wisdom to know the difference between that which is useful for Parliament to change and that which is much better left alone. In case it's not clear from what I have said, so far, I hope Parliament will not find this case for primary legislation approved, but will look to some other ways, such as those that I have suggested, for making this field of law accessible to those whom it most directly affects. Thank you very much.
Well, I avoided the word formidable in my introduction because I wanted those of you who don't know Mrs. Justice Arden to experience it firsthand, the power and polish of one of her presentations. We're very much in her debt for laying out the various aspects of this important issue in public policy. We look forward to seeing the full text in print, along with the other essays in the series. We greatly benefited by your use of the overhead, a technique which I haven't yet mastered, despite the visitations of the university teaching inspectors. Those of you who wish to pursue the argument or would just like to meet the judge are very welcome to join us for a reception on the fifth floor in the Senior Common Room. It's open to everyone. Everyone's welcome. Thank you again, Mary, for a splendid lecture. We're all very grateful.